This is Sportsnet Magazine Live on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Sportsnet Magazine Live, Ben Ennis, alongside Jordan Heath Rawlings and Mike Cormack this week. So much to get to in this very fine program. The Blue Jays try to work their way back to 500. Still some question marks with the offense. Stanley Cup playoffs rolling right along, and the NHL draft lottery going tonight. And fans of all seven Canadian teams very much intent on watching what transpires on CBC later tonight. But we start, gents, with the Toronto Raptors, their 2-7 first-round matchup in the NBA playoffs. It doesn't really feel like a 2-7. And by the way, we'll be giving away a couple of tickets to Game 7, which goes Sunday night, and you can watch it on Sportsnet. We'll be giving away two tickets to Game 7 later on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
So bring tissues if you win those.
Yeah. Tears of joy or tears of sadness. Either way.
What do you think, Ben?
Well, I don't know. How negative are you? Maybe we'll get to that. All right. So the Raptors, I guess, have been the inferior team in three straight games. They were the inferior team in Game 4, quite clearly. Got blown off the floor in Indiana. Came home, won Game 5, but only because they put together a great 12-minute performance in the fourth quarter against the Pacers. Had a chance to close it out in Game 6, and again, got blasted in Indiana. And it feels like, and I know we're just talking about one game here, and anything can happen in 48 minutes, but it feels, Mike, like we're talking about a referendum on what this team is in one game on a Sunday in a Game 7.
Sure, and I feel like the referendum maybe even happened last night. In terms of, do you feel good about this team even if they do win Game 7? Sort of like an absolute blowout, step-on-their-throat performance on Sunday. Does anybody feel confident about their prospects in the second round?
We have seen that in this series, though. Like, we do forget about, what was it, Game 3. They stepped on their throats. That was the best overall performance start to finish by this Raptors team in the postseason. That is in them. And, you know, the first quarter of Game 6, it looked like we were going to see that again.
Sure, but the difference between Game 3 and Game 6 is massive. It's massive. And the Raptors have shown an inability to close out playoff series, and this group has had three kicks at the can now, and short of a blow performance in Game 7, I'm not going to feel very good about their chance in the second round. And really what this is about is it's a referendum on can this group, can this core, can the leadership group of DeMar DeRozan and Kyle Lowry, can the Raptors win an NBA championship with these two leading the team? And if they can't, Masai Ujiri has to do a lot of soul searching this summer and decide where to go with this, because there's a lot of fans right now sitting out there. If you're on Twitter last night, if you're at a bar talk with your buddies, nobody's feeling good about this group regardless of the Game 7 outcome.
There is, so, okay, talking about Masai Ujiri particularly, he, before the playoffs started, before they tipped off from Game 1, the question was posed to him, like, how important is this first-round series? He said, you know, we're not overreacting, and we understand that Masai Ujiri has been a very rash guy. He's been a guy that takes in all the information, doesn't overreact, doesn't react to, you know, fan craziness, which you can't do in his position. But how much do we believe that to be the case, Jordan? Because it really does feel that I'll maybe rephrase the question. How much do we believe that Masai Ujiri really is not going to base his decision on one game, one series, when it comes to the big decisions that are upcoming for this team in the offseason?
Well, I mean, if they lose Game 7, he doesn't have to base it on one game or one series. He has 3 years and three series to base it on, and I don't see how any reasonable general manager, which, you know, Masai seems like he is. He's made some smart moves. He's been patient when he has to. He's been, you know, ready to take his team to the next level and has given them pieces that should get them there. You know, it's not like he's done nothing with this group and hoped that they could get it right this year. You know, he went out and added pieces that should theoretically put them over the top. They had real problems with defense in the playoffs last year. So now you've got Damari Carroll and Bismack Biyombo in there, and those are guys that should make a difference. And I think when we talk about, is it a referendum on this team? The Raptors have some very good supplementary pieces. They've got some really good depth. That second unit has been good. So is this a referendum on the team? I mean, it is, in so much as it's a referendum on what makes up the Raptors. But really, it's a referendum on three guys: DeMar DeRozan, Kyle Lowry, and Dwayne Casey.
Jordan just nailed it right there. That's what this is coming down to, because Ujiri has shuffled the pieces on the chessboard in the absence of his starting backcourt. And when you look at the numbers of these guys in this series, they are unbelievably bad. Grange has it up in his column on sportsnet.ca. Where are they here? They shot 7 of 27 from the floor, 18 points on the night, and they're 60 for 190 or 31.5% for the series. That is horrific.
And Ben just asked if you could win an NBA championship with those guys.
I don't know if those exact words came out of my mouth, but yeah, all right. So, and those are horrible, no question, and it's a different feeling between those two that you have when they have the ball in their hands than we had the 56 times this team won during the regular season. And I'm not letting them off the hook, but it should be stated that they're not playing against pylons here. And the Pacers are not a spectacular team, but they're a very good defensive team and were throughout the regular season. Paul George is a legit superstar, and not just offensively, like a tremendous, tremendous defender as well. We have to factor that in.
There's no question that the Indiana Pacers are a great defensive team, but it was never going to be a cakewalk. You're not going to be facing the kind of teams they face to win 56 games in the playoffs. And if you can't beat a team that has a good defense and a good number one score, you're never going to win in the NBA playoffs. You just can't, you know, you can't have any reasonable expectation of success.
Sixers don't make the playoffs.
Yeah, the Sixers don't make the playoffs. All those teams they beat up on, you know, and they did actually, to be fair, they had a pretty good record this year against the top teams in the NBA. You know, they beat a lot of those top tier teams. But again, I think the thing that we've seen with this Raptors team for 3 years is A, they play differently in the playoffs, and B, those teams that they catch sleeping sometimes in the regular season are always turned on in the playoffs.
Yeah, there's being beaten, and then there's beating yourselves, and the Raptors are beating themselves in the series.
Well, and that's easy to say when you rattle off the numbers that you did. This team's top two scorers, its top two players, the two all-stars on this team have been arguably the worst players. Now, I can make a bit of a distinction between Kyle Lowry's play and DeMar DeRozan's play, especially when you're talking about in game six, because Kyle Lowry understood that the shot hasn't been falling and there might be injury issues. And, you know, I would not be shocked that whenever this playoff run ends that Kyle Lowry's talking about like elbow surgery, because we know he's been banged up with the bursasack, but apparently been able to play through it. We know it's affected his shooting at times this season, but he did other things. And there were certainly times in game six where he was able to play great defense. He was able to create open looks, some great passing. DeMar DeRozan at times did that as well, but there were like cringeworthy moments for DeMar DeRozan, and he's the guy that the big question marks surround this offseason, because Kyle Lowry's under contract for maybe just one more year because he's got an opt-out, but DeMar DeRozan isn't.
And this city will forgive Kyle Lowry because of the way he's played. The way he's played badly, as weird as that is to sound. You know, he's driving the hoop, he's taking charges, he's going down to the dirt, and he's getting messed up and coming back, and yeah, he's missing the shots, but he's actually taking it. Whereas what this city especially, this is the city that fell in love with Ty Domi and John McDonald and Munenori Kawasaki, what this city does not forgive is guys who stay on the perimeter and pull up for 18-foot jump shots and miss them in clutch moments. They can't let that go.
And it's DeRozan's decision-making on the floor, which is really troubling, too. He's not seeing open players. He's taking bad shots. Lowry's taking good shots. He's making the right decisions. Speaking of that elbow issue, like it's definitely bothered him. He's again, in Grange's piece from this morning, he's shooting or shot 32% in the final 10 games of the season.
Yeah.
So there's a large body of work here suggesting that there's something very wrong with this elbow. It's affecting his play. Lowry says it's not, but clearly it is. And then back to your original point here, Ben, about like the question with DeMar DeRozan. Really, what is the question if you're the Raptors? How can you bring this guy back, really? If your desire is to win an NBA championship, we've got 3 years in the playoffs of DeRozan underperforming. We can find a lot of guys to produce an average of 10 points or fewer in the first round of the playoff series for a lot less money than DeMar DeRozan's going to give you.
Yeah, a couple of them are sitting on the bench.
It's not about 56 wins in the regular season. It's like, what can you do in the playoffs? And he's not getting it done.
I just have a difficult time throwing out. I'm a big sample size guy. Like, 82 games is a large sample size.
Three first round series. How's that sample size?
And I can't lump all three of those playoff series together, because 2 years ago you play the Nets in the first round, who were, I know they were the lower seed, but they were favored by Vegas in that series, took them to a game seven. They played well in that series despite having a chance to close it out in game six and couldn't, and then close them out again in game seven. It came down to the last shot and Kyle Lowry blocked at the buzzer in a season in which earlier during that season, they tried to tank and had a trade worked out to send Kyle Lowry to the Knicks that was kiboshed.
That was also house money that series, but go on. Uh-huh. I agree. That Nets team was really good, veteran-laden, tough series.
Last year, that team was bad, and it was papered over, and maybe people thought it was good because of the way they played offensively the first half. But the truth be told, that was not a good team start to finish last year. They never played defense. They were a horrible defensive team, and they relied heavily on isolation and shots that went in. Lou Williams taking shots at the end of the at the end of the quarter. That was just like a bad team that was exposed in the postseason. This team is good. Like, as much as it pains me to say, especially how crushing the losses have been, and they do have a chance still to win the series, this team was good. I watched the majority of their 82 games and the 56 wins, and it was not beating up on the Sixers day in, day out. First of all, the Eastern Conference was much better this year, but they played well against the good teams. I have a difficult time separating what I saw for 82 games against good teams, against bad teams, in tough circumstances and easy ones. And this is not the same team I saw for 82 games.
So if we can attribute Kyle Lowry's offensive shooting struggles anyway to his elbow, what do you think is at the root of DeMar DeRozan's struggles?
An unwillingness to go into the tough areas the way he did in the regular season, because those areas are smaller in the playoffs and they're defended. But hold on, I want to get back to something that Ben said, because Ben said that you can't lump all three of these Raptors playoffs together, which is true. But all that tells me then is they can't win as the underdog. They can't win when they have another, a different kind of seven-game series like they had last year. And so far, they can't win a seven-game series as an overwhelming favorite. They've lost three different ways then, if you want to put it that way, which is arguably more damning.
Are we doing the thing...
By the way, I just gave them a Game 7 loss, which I probably shouldn't
that's where I was going to get to. Are we being a little harsh on this team? And I know
This is Toronto sports radio, Ben. We are conditioned and used to it.
Well, does it change at all if they win a Game 7? And maybe they win it going away on Sunday, which would be a whole lot of fun.
If their goal for the whole season is to prove that they can get out of the first round, congratulations.
I think it is.
And that is the problem. The goal for this group, a 56-win team with a lot of talent, a lot of players who can do a lot of different things, they have all the pieces on paper there to go really far. Like, they could push the Cavs to 6-7 games if everything went their way. They're that tough. They're that talented. The goal should be to get to the NBA Finals. So getting out of the first round is nothing to celebrate. Everything should be building towards how do we prove that we're a championship-caliber team, and they've got to step on the Pacers' throat in Game 7. They've got to win a convincing second round, like, or at least a clean second round without any questions about guys' character or heart, and then go on and hopefully have a competitive conference final. That would be a successful season for this
That
this
sounds
franchise.
Like a fairy tale at this point.
Well, doesn't it, though? Going into the playoffs,
depending on who you asked.
Yeah,
I mean, but... The thing is that's what I see from this team, too, and that's the problem with this team, and I think Mike kind of hit the nail on the head. If you had told them before these playoffs started that you're going to maybe lose a game 7 in the second round, will you take that? They would have paid lip service to no, but really they probably would have because they just can't get out of the first.
I think the difference between the scenario that you're painting and the scenario that still might take place is that it's not that this series is going 7 games, because a lot of people did predict that the Pacers would give the Raptors some trouble.
Sure.
It's the way the losses have taken place, and even the win
in Game 5. Yeah, this should have been over in 5 games if they had played the way they're capable of. Like, those games were there for a majority of these games have been there for them, right?
Yeah, Game 1 especially. Game 1 was, it seemed like the moment was too big. They missed a bunch of free throws.
Moment's always too big for this team.
Well... I mean, is that...
Where's a small moment for them?
You almost got to the point, and I know it's one you want to talk about, Mike, is that we're not just talking about numbers on a page here, and we're not just talking about individual moments. We're talking about personalities, and we're talking about, I don't know, the clutch gene, which, I don't know, being a baseball guy, I kind of shy away from, but different sports are different, and analyzing those moments are different. Where is this team? Like, are we talking about, and Paul Pierce talked about, he said this team does not have that look in their eyes. They don't have it. I mean, how right was he?
Well, I don't know. It looks like he was pretty right now, but it's less about being clutch and more about how pressure affects guys in different ways, and especially like how pressure impacts poor performances and how nerves will affect people, and maybe it affects their decision making. We see it in all sports.
And it compounds too.
It compounds. It builds. It's something that it becomes heavier as performances grow. And I think it's fair to ask about certain guys on this team, and DeMar DeRozan certainly one of them, is whether the pressure is getting to him. It certainly looked last night that he was a very different basketball player, at least in terms of his decision-making, which is something that's very concerning, someone who looked a bit panicked,
he's panicking
on the court at times. And we see that in all sports, and that's something to be concerned about. I don't know if you can quantify clutchness, but I definitely believe that pressure and athletes become panicked in situations, and it affects their decision-making negatively. And I think we've seen that with DeMar DeRozan, especially in Game 6 last night.
Yeah, you can't quantify clutchness very well across sports, I think. You know, there have been lots of...
You can recognize when a guy's panicking.
Yeah, exactly. It's like pornography. You know when you see it. And, you know, DeMar DeRozan is the opposite of that. And when you look at... An interesting comparison, I think, is the Blue Jays team of last year, because that was a team kind of like the Raptors a few years ago, right, where they were sort of middle of the pack and you weren't sure what was going to happen. And then some moves got made and all of a sudden they took off and found themselves in the playoffs. The difference is that whatever you might think is happening to the Blue Jays now, I'm sure we'll get to that. But there are players and personalities on that Blue Jays team that rise to those moments, that take those kind of things on and really make it their own. And part of it may be Kyle Lowry's injury, but I've certainly not seen really one player on that Raptors team seize the moment.
A lot of that is recency bias, though, as well, right? Like,
of course.
Are you forgetting the Kyle Lowry's buzzer beater against the Cavaliers during the regular season? Again, regular season.
I'm not forgetting
totally
that. I just don't care totally about
different.
It.
But, yeah. I mean... Hey, you never know. Somebody could hit a clutch shot in the dying moments of Game 7 on Sunday on
Sportsnet.
I'll
put some money on the fact that it's not DeMar DeRozan.
But then the narrative changes, right? Like, all it takes is one moment.
Yeah, yep. If DeMar DeRozan has a huge Game 7 in a tight, contested game and the Raptors come out on top, I'll be the first guy to congratulate him.
And you know what? He might have a little easier time in a second round when he doesn't have Paul George guarding him as well.
Absolutely. And I think part of it feels like we're beating on DeRozan, which is tough, but
he deserves
painful,
it right now.
It's also,
though.
No, it's kind of like painful because here's a guy that, you know, loves Toronto, works really hard, really popular. He's been a Raptor for a long, long time. People really want this team to do well, and they want DeMar DeRozan to do well. So that's why it kind of hurts the fan base as much as it does.
Yeah, it turns bitter because they are a likable team. You know, the personalities are like, they're likable guys. You want to root for them. You know, they're out there playing hard. And I don't think any of us are sitting here saying they're not playing hard or they're not trying. You know, and I think we'd all love to see this team do well. But at a certain point when the failures just kind of compound on each other, you have to ask the question. And it sucks for DeMar. Trust me, nobody feels worse this morning than DeMar, I'm sure.
Are they too nice? Like, maybe that's part of
it.
Maybe they are. And maybe it starts with the head coach. The head coach is super nice, right? Like, Dwayne Casey is a guy you love to hear whenever he's on the radio station, in interviews, on Sportsnet. I enjoy Dwayne Casey in the media. Is he a hard-nosed guy enough? Is he Tom Thibodeau?
Oh, Phil Jackson's not exactly a hard-nosed guy, and
sure,
he's got lots of rings.
But he also had Shaq and Kobe, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, and I think that's what it comes back to for this Raptors team, and me and you have talked about this before on this show, about what it takes to win in the NBA playoffs, and I've never wavered from my conviction. Is the reason the NBA is down on my list of sports to watch is because one player in the playoffs makes all the difference. You either have one of those top 15 guys in the league that can go out and win you in the game in the fourth quarter, or you don't. And then I'm just not convinced that you can go to the finals without a guy like that.
You'd like to be able to go to the second round. You'd like to be able to beat a mediocre 7 seed in the Indiana Pacers.
And what I think is interesting is I think the model for this current incarnation of the Raptors is like the Pistons team of like the early 2000s. That's what they were kind of hoping they would be, like a championship contender that could do it with like a strong five and a defensive mentality.
Different
but
NBA.
You know what that team was? That team was super tough.
Yes.
That Pistons team.
Yeah.
They were absolute monsters and killers, all of them on the court.
Yeah.
This Raptors group is certainly lacking that right now.
And they had Chauncey Billups, who was, you know, he was a killer.
Mr. Clutch. Yeah. He was one of those guys that you don't always see, but when the game's on the line, he was there. And Ben Wallace was, you know, Bismack Biyombo is great. He's played very well this season. But the Ben Wallace and Rasheed Wallace combo. Yeah, Tayshaun Prince, again. Lockdown defender.
Raptors have those elements, certainly talent-wise and production-wise in the regular season, but it's totally absent in the playoffs.
So the decisions have already been made then. So it sounds like through this conversation, I don't know, has it changed? Were you guys, DeMar DeRozan is a max player during the regular season? Because I had, my mind had been made up that he was not that same guy that took the horrible, horrible shots of 2 years ago. And the
end of last night?
Yeah. That did look like the DeMar DeRozan, like the nightmare scenario DeMar DeRozan, where it's nothing but long twos and contested shots. and no ability to get easy looks. Now, he was not that guy through 82 games this regular season, and I mentally made the change to realizing, and especially considering where the NBA is cap-wise and the ability teams have financially, that I thought, yeah, DeMar DeRozan, max player, that makes sense. That's something you have to do. It's hard for me to go down that path. Where are you guys on that?
I was never down that path. I was waiting for the playoffs to start, and I looked at that path, and I turned around and ran the other way with the playoffs.
It's one of those things where you kind of, there's a reality, and then there's what you think should happen, right? And the reality is that DeRozan is probably going to be a max player or very close to it just because of the market that this exists in. You know, the NBA doesn't exist in a vacuum, and other teams will pay for that because there's nobody else to pay for. But are you going to feel good about having DeMar DeRozan on your team as a max player? I certainly wouldn't, and that wasn't a product of this series. Like, I would have felt that way in the middle of the season. I think I was kind of like, it's a shame that somebody's going to have to pay him the max to get him, because as a non-max player, he can be a valuable member of your team. He just can't be that guy.
And maybe he'll be a max player for Luke Walton in LA with the Lakers, which is a scenario I could see. Although, again, like, narratives change rather quickly, and if they come up with a win in Game 7 on Sunday at 8 o'clock on Sportsnet, maybe we're singing a little different tune. The Blue Jays now back to within two games of 500 after taking Game 1 of their series in Tampa against the Rays. Another strong performance from Aaron Sanchez after a bit of a clunker against the Oakland A's. But again, the offense has not been spectacular, and question marks still remain among the arms in the bullpen. Most notably, Drew Storm. We'll talk a little Blue Jays coming up next. It's Sportsnet Magazine Live. I'm Ben Annis alongside Mike Cormack and Jordan Heath Rawlings. This is the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Fans know that Sportsnet.ca has them covered with news, analysis, highlights, and storytelling. But the lineup also includes podcasts. Here's a taste of Free Association, a Raptors and NBA podcast.
The change in the starting lineup, Patrick Patterson in, Luis Scola out. That's supposed to fix the slow starts. Didn't fix it at all.
Nope.
Arguably worse. I had tweeted there were faint boos early. People were getting mad at me saying that the boos were not faint, that they were loud. So people, before they were even in their seats, because it was a 6 o'clock start, people were already upset. And then the opposite. The closest thing I've seen to what we saw Game 5 first round in baseball last year with the Blue Jays and the Rangers.
I mean, it's hard to put it in the context of baseball because there's such a longer season. Fewer teams get in the playoffs. It's so much harder to make the playoffs in baseball. But yet there was this kind of bat flip feeling moment to that win. Tim McAuliffe of Tim and Sid calling in now.
Cabral Richards said to me, Game 5, the Raptors need a bat flip here. As we watched that fourth quarter from Jurassic Park, there was a definite, I'm not going to go as far as the bat flip, but there was a definite momentum build and gain by this team that I sure hope that they can capitalize on, because they haven't captured the momentum. They haven't captured the hearts outside of Toronto yet, and I wonder if this game does it.
Go to Sportsnet.ca and click on the Podcast Central logo for the scoop on Free Association and all our shows, as well as links to listen and subscribe. Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network, Ben Ennis, Jordan Heath Rawlings, and Mike Cormack. Blue Jays taking game one of their tiny little three-game road trip in Tampa against the Rays, 6-1 over the Rays. Aaron Sanchez good again against Drew Smyly, who's hard luck, 1-3. Rays can't score. The Rays are no good. Blue Jays, I guess the jury's still out on them as well, but the Blue Jays now two games under 500 at 11-13. Two more games to go in this series before they return home to play their American League Division Series foes, the Texas Rangers. So what do we make of this team so far? Because this was a team that was not supposed to rely entirely on its offense, but almost, You were just hoping to get five starters that, like, got you through five or six innings, giving up three or four runs, and you figured that was enough for this offense, especially the way they scored a year ago. You've gotten way more than that from the starting pitching, but the offense has not been great.
Well, listen, if you had to look before this season started and said, after a 24-game, the Blue Jays are going to be 11-13. They're going to be four games out, and it's going to be because the bats haven't been hitting. You would have been like, shoot, I will take that, because the problematic thing would have been to be sitting here at 11-13 and looking at the roster and being like, you know what? The starting pitching is worse than we thought it is. What are we going to do? That is the nightmare scenario. The nightmare scenario is not like all our world-class hitters aren't firing on all cylinders yet. I mean, if there's a way to start 11-13 that makes you optimistic about a team, this is that way, right?
I would think the one question legitimate one I have is the bullpen. Is it deep enough? Roberto Osuna's great. I think Brett Cecil will be Brett Cecil. Can you rely enough on Gavin Floyd and Jesse Chavez and guys of that ilk? Because I have little to no faith in Drew Storen right now.
Yeah, Storen's performance is really troubling. The velocity is down. He's a guy who's had some makeup questions in the past. Obviously, he, shrunk in performance the second half of last season after the Washington Nationals picked up Papelbon. And that's a guy that, he's really concerning, and they need to make a move on that guy. They need to move him out of that role really quickly and find a way to get somebody who can get the job done in there.
It's fair enough to be concerned about the bullpen. I mean, they've given away a few games. Here's the thing about a bullpen, though, in late April and early May is, the bullpen is kind of a living, breathing thing over the course of a season, right? And you should be doing things like moving Drew Storen out of that role and maybe moving Jesse Chavez or somebody else into it. You should be looking at what's there in Buffalo, what's there out on the free agent market, because the bullpen is the one place where you can add pieces that might have a really good fit for little cost during the season. You want to fix your lineup, you got to pay. You want to add a starting pitcher, you got to cough up prospects. But the bullpen you can tinker with. And I think that, again, it's a good thing to be concerned about.
Yeah, and I think we heard Mark Shapiro on The Fan earlier this week speaking with Jeff Blair saying that he really is not going to make any judgments until the 40-game mark, right? Which is fair. So I think that's really, for all these discussion points we're going to go over, is let's give it another 20 games or so and see where we're at. Let's not panic, but certainly Storen is getting close to the panic stage at this point. But some of the hitters, they're going to come around. I mean, Edwin's a notorious slow starter. I remember Jose Bautista in early 2012 had a really bad April, and people were kind of like raising their eyebrows going, well, is this the end of Jose Bautista as an elite slugger? And then he had a monster second half. So These things happen, and they're not 10 games under 500 or anything disastrous like that. So let's give it another couple of weeks, but let's just monitor the guys who are really underperforming. And I think there's certain cases, Storen being one of them, as I just mentioned, where you're getting close to pulling the trigger.
And maybe, a guy like Troy Tulowitzki, too, you sort of become somewhat concerned about, just because we're creeping up now on the time where he will have had four full months as a Blue Jay of a sample size of about a 200 batting average, which is obviously less than ideal. I mean, we've seen him do it in fits and starts. But again, I think it's a question of tempering your expectations for a guy coming from the NL and coming from Coors Field. And regardless of what happens to Troy Tulowitzki, his batting average is not, I promise, but by the end of the year, he won't be hitting 179, and he'll still be a gold glove shortstop, and he'll probably be up there around 250 and hitting some homers.
What are the expectations for Troy Tulowitzki now?
I think they've changed, for me at least. And maybe this is an overreaction, but like you said, Jordan, we're talking about not a minuscule sample size. It's not,
it's getting
huge
there
one.
It's getting towards half a season now,
right? And he was not a guy that was just a Coors Field creation. He did have an OPS over 800 outside of Coors Field, but only slightly above 800, right? So like, he's not Josh Donaldson. He's not a guy that is going to carry a team with his offense alone, and certainly you mentioned it, the defense plays anyways, even if he was a below average offensive guy at that position. I don't know if he's a below average offensive player at shortstop.
He's definitely not.
Considering the position, yeah, he's definitely not below average at that position, but is he a guy that can hit 320 with a 360 on base and 30 home runs? No.
I don't see that guy.
No, I see a guy who can hit you 250 with like a 320 on base and maybe 20 home runs, which is like, it's livable, and certainly with the defense, but not.
But it's disappointing also.
I think so.
Considering $20 million.
What you thought you were getting. Because that guy in Coors Field was unbelievable.
And what you may need next year from that guy. if Jose and Edwin aren't back. That's what's really concerning as well. You need that guy to be a middle of the order bat.
Yeah, no, that's certainly a fair assessment. I think, you know, right now he's, if he can creep up, like Ben said, towards 250 with a 320 on base and 20 home runs, that plays in the five or six spot in this Blue Jays lineup. Does it play in the three spot in next year's? Of course not. But again, I mean, even with...
That's what they need from him, though.
That is, well, that's what they might need from him next year if Batista and Edwin leave and if there's nobody there to replace them. Like, that's I think we can all agree that would be a pretty bad scenario to be dealing with.
They also
with.
Need it this year, given the way they're hitting, but...
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. So who are the guys that we know what we're going to get? Josh Donaldson, I think we can all agree. We know what you're going to get from them. Same with Jose Bautista. Same, I think, with Edwin Encarnacion. And as poorly as Troy Tulowitzki's played, I think we have an idea.
He's got a pedigree. Let's give him that. I mean, even though it's been a bad 4 months, let's give him the due that he's built up over his career.
Michael Saunders has been very good. Justin Smoke is not a good offensive player, and I've railed against an everyday Justin Smoke many times.
409 on base percentage. I'll leave you alone.
Yes. Justin Smoke's not very good. If you're playing him every day at first base, you got some problems.
Maybe you can just hit
run into him. He can run into one. He can't really take enough walks to justify playing a corner infield spot in the American League East. Russell Martin is incredible. He's had moments in his career where he has had a low batting average, but has always had the ability to take walks, always had the ability to hit for power, and we know the defense is ridiculous, and we know also he's dealing with a neck injury that has certainly contributed to the 9 straight strikeouts and the low batting average. And the defensive problems, frankly, see a throw in game one of the Rays series that didn't look very much like Russell Martin. Kevin Pillar is Kevin Pillar, and second base is a hole offensively.
For now.
So are the expectation levels offensively, not that this team is a bad offensive team, but they did score like over 100 runs more than the second team in baseball as far as run scoring goes, the New York Yankees. They outscored them by a ton, almost scored 900 runs last year. Has that knocked our expectations out of whack? And is that maybe something that we should not expect in 2016 from this Blue Jays team?
Well, I think I'm really concerned with Russ Martin at this point. The numbers are just so off his career norms, and he has played a lot of baseball the past 3 years. He's 33 years old. He's caught a ton of games, seen a lot of playoff baseball. Usually a guy who takes a lot of walks. He's only got 4 walks and 67 plate appearances this year. He's not slugging at all. You mentioned the throws. I worry about him being like really worn down, and they need some offense from him really at the bottom of that lineup. They need 15 home runs from Russ. Second base, Ryan Goins. He is what he is, to use like a bad cliche, but if Devin Travis, who took live batting practice or had a simulated game yesterday.
Yeah, he played in extended spring training, which is like the weirdest thing ever. Yeah, they actually play games.
But he doesn't run to the bases or anything like that. But he hit a couple of line drives, and he's feeling really good. The Blue Jays all of a sudden really need him to come back, hopefully before the All-Star break. He seems to be progressing quite nicely. If he can come back and hit a little bit and maybe move Ryan Goins into a bench role or send him back down to AAA, that would be a huge bonus for the team. But they really need a lot out of Martin, and I'm really concerned at what point like this guy might need to spend a little time on the disabled list. And then you got Josh Tolley behind him, and you're not getting any better offensive production from him.
That is the worst part, to me, of the entire Blue Jays roster construction, is the lack of depth at catcher, especially because you have a catcher that, regardless of how he's hitting so far this year, is elite. He's elite defensively at his position. He's an elite game caller. And in the past, he's also been an elite bat at his position. And he's not getting it done right now. And you've seen him be pulled from a couple of games and miss a couple other ones with neck spasms. And that's the kind of thing that, especially at this point in the year, when my first reaction to everything is relax, you know, and what you want to do at this point in the year when your elite catcher's battling neck spasms is to be able to say, Russ, take 7 days, you know, just sit down for a week, sit on the couch, relax. And we have somebody here that can cover for you. And you look at Josh Tolley, who, God bless him, can sometimes catch a knuckleball, but can't do anything else.
Yeah, like if you're going to get Josh Tolley offensive production from Russ Martin, you might as well sit Russ Martin. It's a long season. Give the guy some rest.
That would be a tough pill to swallow. And then AJ Jimenez or Tony Sanchez gets called up.
Russ Martin's 391 OPS is tough.
Right, yeah. But he did have a very slow start to the season a year ago. I understand that there's different circumstances this year with the potential injury. We don't know the extent of that. We can only you know.
I mean, you can see it, though. You can see it. You can see it in
his neck.
No, but you can see it in his throws to second base that are usually so on target. And his swings. He's swinging right through stuff. And that's not Russ Martin. Like, Russ Martin's always been a pretty decent contact hitter. Like Mike said, he's always taken his walks. Those are the things when a guy is feeling it and is pressing and is desperate to make something happen. And I agree. As much as it might be tough to swallow Josh Tolley for a week, you know, Russ is not giving you much better.
I might counter with, he's a catcher and he's always hurt. Like, at the end of the last year, he was destroyed. He was hamburger meat by the end of last year, played through it. Eventually, they gave him the break of calling up Josh Tolley just before September so he could catch R.A. Dickey. And certainly that apparently took more of a toll on Russell Martin than maybe we anticipated. But this is what catchers do, and it's what Russell Martin does, plays through stuff. And that's part of his value because, again, he's not a one-way player. And I guess the key for me, if the injury is affecting the defense, then maybe you have to look at something. But we only have the sample size of like the one throw that's been lackluster.
For sure, and this is what catchers do, which is why you should have a good backup catcher, or at least
a teams do.
I know it's a luxury, but for a team that relies on their catcher as much as the Blue Jays rely on Russell Martin to work with the pitchers and to keep a starting staff that, to be fair, on paper is not in the upper echelon of the league, although they've pitched fantastic this year. You need somebody who you can turn to and make sure Russell Martin is healthy for the stretch, because if he's not, I don't know if that starting rotation holds up.
Yeah, and if you were to run down some of the biggest questions, areas of concern for the Blue Jays going into the season, a potential long-term injury or poor production from Russ Martin was one of them.
Yeah. There's just no depth there. But again, like, there's very few teams that have, like the Red Sox kind of do with Ryan Hannigan and Christian Vasquez and Blake Swihart now in AAA. Like, you look at...
I mean, maybe you can make a deal for a AAA catcher like that. You know?
It's very difficult inside your own division. But, yeah, I mean, you look at the Royals. Like, who's...
There are catchers out there, though, that you could trade for. There's a few of them that have been kicking around.
But then you go back to the whole Dickey question. Who's going to catch Dickey? You going to carry three catchers on your roster?
No, you can't.
They don't have enough depth to be able to do that.
But we did mention that the starting staff has exceeded expectations. It really has. I mean, the only guy who, by the numbers, has been bad this season is R.A. Dickey, who is R.A. Dickey. And you look at the peripheral numbers, he's still R.A. Dickey.
He's right there.
And he's due for a regression back to, you know,
R.A. Dickey.
ERA of 4 and 200-plus innings in the American League East, which plays, and that's exactly what the Blue Jays are paying for this year.
And if that lineup was the way the lineup was supposed to be coming into the year, if guys hadn't scuffled out of the gate and stuff, that would be playing extremely well. Like, R.A. Dickey's numbers so far would be playing pretty well, right? It's because the offense hasn't been there that you're noticing it more.
Yeah, his results have been poor, though. But the other guys, the other four guys have, like, frankly been spectacular.
Has Stroman been spectacular?
I would say twice he's left with the bases loaded, and twice all three earned runs have come around to score. Once in a grand slam by Brock Holt, and then once in that meltdown by the bullpen against the White Sox. So his ERA should be well under 4, mm-hmm. and he's taken the ball against some pretty good teams and gone deep into them. Now
his stuff is there. When you look at watch him pitch, he's got the whole arsenal, and you know he might miss his spot once or twice, but he's put them in position to win almost every game, I think, he started so far, with the exception of, again, a couple bad hits.
And to be fair, he did those runs at the bullpen cost him. He put those guys on.
Yes. Situations. No, I get it. Right. You don't expect 100% runners
to
score.
Just to be fair, no, I know, but when they needed a shutdown inning, you know, like, I just want to be fair. Like, he...
Okay.
They needed that.
So. All right, so you're not satisfied with Marcus Stroman.
No, I am satisfied. I'm very satisfied with Marcus Stroman.
You don't sound
I'm
satisfied.
Watching
I
him
want to
with,
satisfy
I'm
going to
watch
Cormac.
Him with... Wow, that's really dirty. I actually just want to... I'm really fascinated to see how Stroman performs over the entire first half of the season, because the sample size was still, like, quite small.
Yep.
From his rookie season, the playoffs, as awesome as he was. I really want to see how he holds up over a long season.
I mean, he's built... Yeah, I agree you want to see how the durability works. But in terms of the sample size, I mean, he's pitched now almost a full season's worth of starts and has been very good. Like, as a rookie season, his first 30-some starts in the big leagues are rookie of the year caliber if they're over a full season. Right now, obviously, you want to make sure that he can hold up over a full season and do that. Yep. But I think the question coming in is, could Marcus Stroman be that guy who, when he comes out on the mound, can go against the top lineups in the league and duel against the top pitchers in the league and give this lineup a shot to win? And I think he's done that in every game.
He's left a couple of games in situations where you kind of went, wish he closed that one.
Yeah, right? David Price has stunk this year as well.
David Price had 14 strikeouts in his last start.
Right, and I don't know if necessarily you want...
And I'm not talking about David, David Price.
Chris Archer has stunk this year, right? Like, there's these guys off to a lot slower starts than Marcus Stroman.
Marcus Stroman's not off to a slow start. I'm not worried about Marcus Stroman. I'm just saying I'm curious to see how he performs over the first half of the season.
We're curious.
We got about a minute and a half before we got to take a break. The one guy, to me, that's jumped out, because Aaron Sanchez, while I'm pleasantly surprised with what he's done, like, that was in there. You knew that was there, and you saw it for four or five starts before he went on the DL last year. Marco Estrada, I guess I'm also impressed that he's able to carry over his success from a year ago. J-Hap, like, has just jumped out of nowhere for me. He looks like a totally different guy than his first go around with this Blue Jays team.
He finally figured it out, right? He was a guy that was always supposed to have the stuff and have the makeup to be a solid middle of the rotation starter.
Wasn't J-Hap originally someone that Alex Anthopoulos really coveted in a Roy Halladay potential deal to the Phillies at a deadline? Like, that's how highly thought of J-Hap was at one point in time, mm-hmm. as a prospect.
But he's never been what he was in Pittsburgh, what he's been in, and I get it, limited sample size this season. Like, the Blue Jays' early sample size, I mean, the strikeouts aren't exactly there, but they're getting the Pittsburgh Pirate J-Hap.
Yeah, J-Hap doesn't need to strike guys out. He just has to not walk guys. That's always been an issue for J-Hap, is giving the free pass. He's always had the stuff. He's got the three pitches. He's got the frame to do it, and he's a guy who's coming into his own. He's 33 years old. We all know lefties starters typically take a little bit longer. That's certainly been the case with J-Hap, and that was a nice bit of business in the offseason for the Blue Jays. I know a lot of fans rolled their eyes when they signed him, but considering the acquisition cost and the potential upside, which is what we're seeing right now, that was a terrific signing.
Yeah, and if you look at the two signings next to each other, the Estrada and Hap signings.
Estrada's been fantastic.
I mean, that's the money that you would spend on one guy that you would hope could be at the top of your rotation, and you got two guys who, again, small sample size, but look to be two rock solid middle of the rotation guys, which is for, what is it, total $25 million a year, something right around there. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but like, that is a good deal for two guys that can pitch, you know, twice every 5 days.
Yeah, it'd be nice if they were backed up with a little offense, but who knows? That might change at any moment now. It is a rather large weekend for people who enjoy the National Hockey League. On this side of the border, all seven Canadian franchises in the NHL have a chance at the number one pick and Austin Matthews. We'll break down their chances, who needs them the most, and where we think the ping pong balls will fall coming up next. I'm Ben Annis alongside Mike Cormack and Jordan Heath Rawlings at Sportsnet Magazine Live on the Sportsnet Radio Network. Now I know that it's you. You're lucky, lucky, you're so lucky. Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network, Ben Annis, Mike Cormack, Jordan Heath Rawlings, 7 o'clock on CBC tonight. The NHL Draft Lottery. I mean, there's going to be millions, billions of people watching. They'll be all over the globe, they'll be watching tonight. Well,
did you know you could watch it all over the globe on sportsnet.ca, Ben?
Well, I do now.
There you go.
Yeah. The people from Finland can watch.
Yeah.
Finland is going to be big into the draft lottery this year.
Well represented, probably at picks 2 and 3. And I know everybody's done it. They've done their draft lottery simulation on air. But you know what? We're not too proud to admit we're followers.
Well, they don't let me on the air much, and I haven't had a chance to do this yet. So.
Okay, so I'm going to do one right now.
Yeah.
All right. Oh, boy. Actually,
Uh-oh.
Do it slow. Right.
Well, at number 3. Start with 3.
All right. 3, Toronto Maple Leafs.
Oh,
second, Edmonton Oilers, and your NHL draft lottery winner, the Colorado Avalanche.
Wow.
Oh.
Which is, you know what? I don't know if that's a disaster for the Maple Leafs. I think there's and Andrew Walker on his show.
Yeah, 4 is the bad one.
Yeah, right. Like, 3 is not as good as 1 or 2 because I think Lane and Matthews, and maybe we do this as we approach drafts and there's a consensus number 1 as we try to pick holes in them. And say that 2 is almost as good, or maybe there's some people who think 2 is better than 1. But it does seem like 4 is much worse than 3, right?
Yeah, it's a three player top tier. So whoever's in 4th, hey, you'll get a good player, but you know, you'll
not
be feeling
franchise altering.
You'll be feeling bad at the end of tonight for sure.
There's very few people saying that the top three projected draft picks will not be a good player. Like, they feel super confident that that's the case, that you will get like a stud player in the top three. After that, chances are really good, but sometimes guys don't pan out at four, five.
Right. And the NHL draft is a bit of a crapshoot, but not as much as some other drafts. Like, I think Major League Baseball is the biggest crapshoot of them all, because you never know what's going to happen outside of one. The number one picks have panned out in recent vintage.
If you can sign them, yeah.
But yeah, there is some degree of certainty with these top three players. And the Maple Leafs, of course, have the best chance at landing number one, but that's only 20%. Who needs Austin Matthews the most? It's an interesting question. And maybe we can just talk about the seven Canadian teams. Who needs him the most?
Oh, probably the Canucks. If you're talking about a team that, you know, lacks pieces to build on and is sort of caught in that transition mode where they're not fully committed to a rebuild, but probably should be, but can't really afford to right now. So in that sense, if nothing else, this A, accelerates the rebuild, or maybe even convinces you that you need to rebuild and that you have a piece that you can start that with, which makes it easier maybe to let go of some of those older players.
Yeah, I agree with Jordan. It's the Canucks, and if only because winning the lottery would allow ownership to go to the fan base and say, hey, we've got a guy we can build around here now. Please allow us to go out and do the other necessary moves that we need to make to start rebuilding this franchise, because in the absence of winning the lottery, or maybe even getting second, or maybe if they get number two in Lonnie, it's easy for them to do it, but that's such an impatient fan base, and they really need to do the hard work of rebuilding there. And if they don't win the lottery, it's going to be a really ugly and fascinating summer in the West Coast.
They're in a terrible spot right now, because you have these great players who are, you know,
still really good,
still effective, though not as great as they once were.
They can't carry a team on their own.
Not good enough to carry a team on their own. And, you know, it's very similar to what you saw in the first round happen to Detroit, right? Losing to Tampa Bay. You have these two great players who are not as good as they once were and can't carry a team on their own. The difference is that the Wings have some young players. The Canucks really, like, if you look at their roster, there is nobody you can project on that roster as a guy who you can build a cup contender around.
What does it say about the team that did finish 30th and has the best shot at Austin Matthews that we don't talk about the Maple Leafs as needing him the most, which is kind of shocking? Like, there's enough there? There's enough
enough, but there's a lot more than what the Canucks have.
Yeah, it's just the Canucks are in such a bad place. I mean, I think the Leafs would be second or third in terms of the list of teams that really need him, but at least they have something.
And everyone agrees that the Leafs are on the right path and they're doing things the right way, and they have a plan. Nobody knows what the Canucks' plan is right now.
Yeah, that's the thing, is that the Leafs have committed to the next two or three years of the franchise that will be spent slowly building a core that should mature into a cup contender. But at least there's a track, you can see a destination with the Canucks, you don't know.
And we've seen some of the Leafs' top prospects play in the NHL for a bit. We've seen that they have some skill, some talent. Mm-hmm. The Marlies are awesome. So there's light at the end of the tunnel in Toronto. It might be a very dim light at the moment, but there is a light.
But and the people, I think it's not even just a dim light. Like, I think if you look at what they have in the system, which is good and is going to contend for the Calder Cup this year. It's a very strong minor league team. And then you look at the organization that they've put in place, right? And that to me is the real light at the end of the tunnel, because the difference, this and again, another huge difference between the Leafs and the Canucks is you look at the guys running the Leafs, they are men that come from organizations with pedigree, right? They've done things like Lou Lamoriello is, you know, one of the better general managers of the last generation. Mike Babcock is the best coach of his generation. Brendan Shanahan came up through the Red Wings culture and has all of that behind him.
Like Kyle Dubas did a great job in the Sioux.
Yeah, they've all got resumes as long as your arm in terms of like what they've accomplished in hockey. Whereas you look at the Canucks and they, you know, that leadership group, what have they done to make you think like, these are the guys I want in charge of rebuilding my franchise?
If you ask a Canucks fan, nothing. They're not happy. But it's interesting, we're talking about like teams and why the Leafs may need Matthews too. All the prospects with the Leafs we're talking about, a lot of them are like Wieners, Marner, Nylander. You could debate whether they're centers, but it's really hard, almost impossible, to win the Stanley Cup without a big, true number one center.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and a lot of those Marlies are small.
Yeah. Where are the Leafs going to find that guy if it's not Austin Matthews? If, let's say, somebody comes along next year, maybe they get a center who becomes that guy. But right now, they don't have that guy in their system.
Yeah. It's a concerning thing because that's how you win right now. I mean, unless you're the Edmonton Oilers, in which case you stockpile all of those big yeah. franchise centers and still don't win.
And
but
then the Leafs' goal is clearly to win the Stanley Cup. So they need that horse, that number one center, and maybe Auston Matthews is that guy. But right now in their system, it appears maybe that guy develops at a somewhere. Maybe it's Marner or Nylander if they have a growth spurt or something, become monsters. But right now it appears that they don't have that guy.
Well, if you ask, you know, some of the folks around here, Auston Matthews will be an excellent third-line center behind Stamkos and Tavares.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Tavares, that question gets asked in a couple of years. Stamkos is very much a question that is resolved this offseason.
And a really interesting one now with the injury and with what's happened in Tampa Bay and other teams who are going to step in.
Well, I've heard it mentioned that maybe his... whether he's a Toronto Maple Leaf in 2016-2017 depends on whether the Maple Leafs win the draft lottery. If you have Auston Matthews, not that you don't need a Stephen Stamkos, but it makes it a little less.
Maybe they need him even more if they have Auston Matthews. Now, hear me out. Like, do you want Auston Matthews? I don't know the kid personally, but it makes Auston Matthews' life as a Toronto Maple Leaf a lot easier if Stephen Stamkos is here as your number one center or even top line winner with Matthews wearing the C, taking all those questions on a daily basis. If Steven Stamkos doesn't come here in the summer and Auston Matthews is taken first overall by the Toronto Maple Leafs, can you imagine the spotlight on this kid right away?
Oh, yeah. I mean,
not to say he can't handle it, but like Steven Stamkos being here would make it a hell of a lot easier on him.
It to a point, because I think that being the number one pick for the first number one pick for the Maple Leafs in forever and coming in there with all this hype, it's not going to be easy on him regardless of who else is on the Leafs. I mean, it would be nice for sure to have
easier.
Yeah, slightly.
Sure.
I mean, it would be nice to have a superstar captain already there and already ready to, you know, have the huge scrum in the dressing room after a loss or whatever. But to say that, I mean... You know, there's 40 hockey reporters at practice every day. Some of them will find their way to writing about whether Matthews is succeeding or failing and pronouncing on him way too early, as we love to do in this market. But, you know, I think that what Ben said is correct. I think it does depend a lot on whether or not they win the lottery, whether they go after Stamkos at the money he's going to require, just because you're getting that financial control for a few years with Matthews and you'll have him as a restricted free agent. And it gives you a chance, especially with the discounts that Kadri and Riley have taken. It gives you a chance to have a real core that you can build on under cost control for a long time. And at that point, maybe Stamkos is worse fit to that because he puts your salary cap selection out of whack. And you know that even though you might like to hope you take a discount, there's going to be so many teams lining up with the money that you can't count on that at all.
And you just got out of those prohibitive contracts of Phil Kessel and Dion yeah. Phaneuf.
Now, Stamkos is another tier above those yeah. guys. Like, well, he's going to deserve that money. I'm not saying he's necessarily going to turn a profit on it with what he does for your team, but there is no question
Phil
he deserves
Kessel's
it in a way.
Phil Kessel's a 30-goal scorer, right?
Steven Stamkos.
Steven Stamkos it does things as a hockey player that Phil Kessel doesn't, hasn't, can't. Etc. Yeah, Steven Stamkos and Phil Kessel both score goals, and that's where the similarity ends.
If Steven Stamkos tried to eat a hot dog, yeah, Gary Roberts would slap it out of his mouth. Never happened.
Yeah, Kessel's beating him at a hot dog eating competition, without question. All right, before we move on to the Stanley Cup playoffs and the second round underway, the unasked question so far between us, at least on the air, has been, where do the Arizona Coyotes fall into this? Because there has never, I mean, to the best of my knowledge, ever been a top prospect that's, one, been an American, two, been from Arizona, and three, been in a circumstance where there's been a franchise in Arizona that desperately needs to create some sort of fan interest. They're in the lottery. I mean, they could win it. You never know. But if they don't, there's, we imagine, going to be a hefty price that will be demanded for Auston Matthews, but that the Coyotes won't make an offer seems probably not correct.
I would be shocked if the Coyotes did not win the lottery and then did not call whoever won the lottery to say, hey, let's have a coffee sometime. Let's chat.
Yeah, they'll call.
Do you have FaceTime? Let's do this.
You wouldn't be doing your due diligence as if you didn't call and try to make that happen. I think there's probably a very limited number of teams who are in the lottery right now who would consider trading that pick, unless it was for a Kings Ransom. Yeah, the Oilers would have to. I mean, especially because the one thing that you'd probably want from the Coyotes would be Ekman-Larsson, and that is exactly what the Oilers desperately need. So they'd be there. There might be a couple other teams, but like, would the Canadians trade it? No. Would the Leafs trade it? No. Would the Canucks trade it? No. Flames? Probably not. They already have a very solid defense. So Senators? No. They like franchise players like that, franchise centers like we just talked about, are so, so rare that you can't afford to pass one up.
And he's worth more to the Arizona Coyotes than any other franchise.
Well,
by a mile.
The one scenario we didn't paint there when you went through the teams, whether they do it or not, what if the Coyotes end up two and you can get Lane and Ekman-Larsson, or like you get the guy.
Well, yeah, if the Coyotes end up two and offer the number two pick and Ekman-Larsson, that deal is probably getting done.
They've already fired one GM this offseason. They don't need to fire another one.
All right. It is Sportsnet Magazine Live. Ben Annis, Mike Cormack, Jordan Heath-Rawlings. Let's move along to the second round Stanley Cup playoffs. First round was a whole lot of fun. I'll miss the Blues and Blackhawks, but we have to move on. It's a shame, but it looks like we have a series that'll be almost as compelling, maybe even more so.
Nashville, San Jose?
No. Capitals, Penguins is the matchup we all anticipated we might see in the second round, one we looked forward to at the time, one we are enjoying the spoils of through one game, a spectacular game, an overtime game, a star-filled game, a hat trick, and an overtime winner from TJ Oshie, and some legacies on the line here. Some narratives. Oh, boy, do we love our narratives. Sidney Crosby, Alex Ovechkin, one has a cup, one has a couple of gold medals, the other has a whole lot of nothing. A bunch of President's Trophies. I don't know how much Alex Ovechkin is.
Rocket Richard yeah. trophies,
sure,
Ben.
Sure,
like a whole mantelpiece full of them.
Yeah, that's all well and good. But there is, Mike, the potential for some, not rewriting of history, but like, a changing
updating the
of
Wikipedia
the narrative.
Page, maybe. Yeah,
yeah, maybe after this series.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially if Ovechkin manages to go on, has a good series, wins a Stanley Cup. He'd have as many Stanley Cups as Sidney Crosby. If he managed to win a Conn Smythe trophy, he'd have one more Conn Smythe trophy than Sidney Crosby, which would be interesting given their career arcs and where they were the last time they met in 2009 in the playoffs. I think there's obviously far more on the line for Ovechkin, but there is quite a bit on the line for Sidney Crosby as well. And I'm sure he would desperately, desperately love to get another cup. He's taken a lot of crap in the media. There's people like me that kind of wonder if he's like living up to the enormous hype, as awesome as he's been. I'm just kind of surprised that he hasn't won more than one cup by now. So if you can get a second one, especially like coming through the concussions and the really slow start to this season and coming on and playing amazing, I think it'd be like an amazing feat for Crosby to win a Stanley Cup this season. But if he loses this round and then Ovechkin goes on and he wins that Conn Smythe, and he's had, what was his eighth 50-goal season this year? Is that right?
I don't know.
Like it's crazy. So
it's a lot of 50 goal
I think
seasons.
Then we kind of, I think the rivalry between the two guys just goes to another level if Ovechkin goes on to win the cup this year and they both have a cup. And then next season, it's like all bets are off and let's see these two go at it one more time. I think it's been great that Crosby's come on the second half, because those questions in the first half, a lot of people were wondering whether we had seen the best of Sidney Crosby. And there's not as much, but there is certainly a lot on the line for him as well in this series.
Well, I really hope that Sidney Crosby can win this series and go on to win a cup so he can shake this bust label that you're applying to
him. I didn't say it was a bust.
I'm just saying, he's not lived up to the enormous expectations only by being the greatest player of his generation and leading his country to two gold medals and winning a Stanley Cup and going to another Stanley Cup final and winning Hart Trophy and Art Ross trophies and coming back from a potentially career-ending concussion mm-hmm. to once again lead his team and coming back to nearly come close to catching Patrick Kane for the scoring title, yep. despite starting the year so terribly. I mean, I, for one, wonder whether Sidney Crosby can possibly live up to this hype that we've piled on his shoulders.
Since it's sports and we're just spitballing here.
I know.
Would you be surprised if Sidney Crosby ended his career with only one Stanley Cup title?
Would I be surprised?
Yes.
I mean, it depends on what happens to him the rest of his career. If he plays on a team like the one he's on now, that
he's had a ton of talent around him his whole career.
Yeah, well, he's had a ton of top tier talent around him, and not a lot below that, right? The Penguins for a long time, and they continue to be, although to their credit, they seem to have gelled a lot over the last half season. The Penguins have always been a top heavy team the entire Sidney Crosby era, and now that's a function of the fact that they have to pay Crosby and Malkin, but really, like, if you look at the last 4 or 5 years or so of the Penguins, you have Crosby, you have Malkin, you have Fleury, Letang, and then maybe James Neal. Like, let's be real. What Crosby's done, he's done dragging the corpse of Chris Kunitz along for the ride.
Yeah, and it could be just the parity in the NHL as well. And part of it, too, is just the era that we grew up watching a lot of this hockey. And you grew up watching Lemieux and Sakic and Forsberg and Yzerman, these guys who are constantly in conference finals and Stanley Cup finals. And you just
because they were surrounded with hugely hyped, overpaid talent because there was no cap.
Sidney Crosby and Evgeny Malkin, as much like they just haven't, for whatever reason, been able to like take their games. That they're a notch below the Sakics, the Forsbergs, in my eyes. I expected those two guys to be there or more. I expected them to be like the Islanders or.
But this is really interesting. When I see you looking at what has happened over those eras that we grew up watching hockey, and I can understand looking at the Red Wings and Avalanches of those years and saying, why isn't Sidney Crosby winning cups and going to finals all the time like these two teams? And for every Yzerman and Sakic that were doing that, I mean, I know because I was a fan of those Red Wings teams in those days, they brought in anybody they wanted to help them out. Like, it wasn't Steve Yzerman doing that. It was Yzerman and Fedorov and Shanahan and Lidstrom and Chelios
and Hull.
And Hull and Datsyuk. And they even brought in Dominic Hasek when they needed to, you know, and Dominic Hasek was making $8 million a year back
after
then.
After Curtis Joseph couldn't
carry
the mail.
Exactly. And so it's a different era in which, and that's why I'm talking about the Penguins being top heavy. Those Red Wings and Avalanche teams, they were that heavy all the way down the lineup.
And then look at Toews and Kane. Like, they've been able to do it with top heavy lineups.
Yeah, there's not enough depth there. And maybe
although,
the
again, if you look at those Hawks teams, and you look at those Hawks teams that have won the cup, right? That first Hawks team that won the cup.
Loaded.
Oh my gosh. You look at like Andrew Ladd was playing third or fourth line minutes on that team. Bufflin was the sixth defenseman. Like, that was a stacked team. And the Penguins have never given Crosby a team that stacked ever.
What about Ovechkin? Now, Ovechkin's.
Speaking of not getting it done with stacked teams.
Right. And they've been the best team in the regular season. They've won their president's trophies. And he's a different player than Crosby, right? He is way more a pure goal scorer, not as much the distributor, plays with, I guess, a more physical edge. Although Crosby gets into it physically, he can be on the receiving end of some physicality as well, as noted by the concussions. But he does not have one. So, I mean, to me, one changes the game.
Oh, absolutely.
Ask Charles Barkley if one changes the game. Ask Dan Marino if one changes
absolutely.
The game.
Absolutely.
Barkley's a really good comparison, actually, to Ovechkin, because in 93, when Barkley's sons played the Bulls, I believe Barkley was the MVP. I think they might have had the best record in the league that year, too. If not, they were certainly the top seed in the West. And they had a chance to win that, and that would have changed Barkley's entire career, the way people perceive him, even though he was an all-time great player. The same pressure's on Ovechkin this year. It's like, get it done this year, or you're kind of wondering, like, then probably, like, never.
Well,
like,
if he can't get it done this year, I mean, they were a historically great team in the regular season.
And they have everything.
Yeah, there's no holes in the lineup, right?
Zero holes. And
there's
you've got
depth all the way down.
Arguably, with Carey Price being out, the best goaltender in the world right now, and Braden Holtby, there's no excuse for them not to get it done.
And it's like their fifth best scorer is the guy that goes out and gets a hat trick in game one, right? Like that's a loaded lineup. That's the kind of lineup Sidney Crosby would kill for these last 5 years.
Adding the depth like TJ Oshie and Justin Williams and all these guys, pieces that they didn't have in previous years. Like,
they have to get it done.
Yeah, they will be grossly disappointed if they don't get it done.
I think we agree that the winner of this series is going to win the East, right?
Well, I mean, I don't know if Cormac agrees. I do.
Yes. I only hesitated because that Ben Bishop was terrible in game one, but he was so good in the first round. He's one guy that could like steal a couple of games. And the Lightning are a talented team. And at the start of the season, a lot of people thought them as an Eastern Conference favorite.
Well, they won it a year ago.
And if the Lightning can win this series and Stamkos comes back for the third round, I mean,
they're
he's already kind
then.
Of practicing in a red jersey, right? And then they're a team that's a wild card, right? You don't know how quickly they could get hot. I mean, Stamkos is a guy that can win a couple games in a series by himself if
Even
he's on.
He was rather quiet last year in their run to the Stanley Cup final.
Pekka Rinne stole the final two games of the Ducks Predator series out of nowhere. So
Ben
Bishop could certainly do that. For
the kind of stuff that happens, right? And I think I would give him a shot against Pittsburgh or Washington if Stamkos is back and playing.
I would pick Pittsburgh or Washington, but I wouldn't be shocked if Tampa Bay gave him a good run.
All right, so let's go to the West because those two series are underway as well. The Blues dropping game one in Dallas 2-1. Ooh, the Stars kept an opponent to one goal, which is Not great for an entertainment value standpoint, but something that is not their norm. And the San Jose Sharks, they get rid of the first round bugaboo. They knock off their state rivals in the Los Angeles Kings in five games. Like, there was no drama in that, which you thought at least there would be a St. Louis Blues scenario where they, the carpet was pulled out from under them. It never happened. And then they win game one at home against the Predators 5-2. Maybe the Sharks is a good place to start because they're a team that, not unlike the Capitals, have had incredible regular seasons, and the teams in recent vintage that we thought would make a run in the postseason, it's not been there for whatever reason. And now they got a guy who used to wear the C in Joe Thornton. I don't know. Might be a pretty good story if he's hoisting the cup in June.
I think it'd be an awesome story. Joe Thornton's obviously a fan favorite. He had an awesome year. He's 36 years old. He had another terrific season. Brent Burns was a monster. He was nominated for the Norris Trophy. Martin Jones had an awesome season in net. They've got a lot of pieces there. There's going to be lots of questions until they get to the final. I'm not buying until they get to the final, but I'd love to see them there. I think they're going to win this round. I think they'd have a hard series against St. Louis if that was the matchup, but I'd love to see it. And I think their five-game win over the Kings was probably the most underappreciated performance in the first round.
Yeah. I mean, the Kings were a dominant regular season possession team. And, you know, when you watch that series, first of all, for a five-game series, it was a great series.
Tremendous hockey.
Like, just great hockey. Just two teams that could have easily won the Stanley Cup going together in the first round. And, yeah, like Mike says, it's just such a sentimental story for Joe Thornton, who I think is a guy who's pretty beloved by his peers around the league as well, just sort of known as a great guy in the dressing room. And he's one of the few guys that can challenge Brent Burns for beard game, too, which is an impressive accomplishment. But, yeah, I'd love to see San Jose versus either Pittsburgh or Washington in the final. And I picked the Blues over Dallas in a seven game series, but I think a Dallas San Jose series in the Western Conference final would just be fun.
Yeah, it seems like it'd be a whole lot of fun. A lot of goals scored in that.
Yeah, just up and down too. Like, I mean, I know Joe Thornton's not the fastest guy anymore, but that San Jose team can skate. Those Stars guys are going up, and like it's quite a matchup.
A lot of green and teal in that series.
Yeah, the color clash would.
It would look
cost
awesome
it some
in 4K.
Points.
Well,
4K plug.
Well, should we talk about that series then? Because the Stars did, as mentioned, take game one, 2-1 of the Blues. Blues getting through their playoff bugaboo. And, I mean, it took seven games, and it took even blowing a two-goal lead in game seven and coming back with a strong performance in that third period to knock off the defending champs to get through to the second round, the first time in 4 years they've been here. And then you kind of thought, well, okay, they're the favorites going into the series against the Stars team that, while they had a great regular season, there's certainly some questions about their ability to keep the puck out of their own net, goaltending an issue, and their style up and down play seems counterintuitive to what we know about playoff hockey, and the teams that go deep in it don't normally play as loose.
That's why they're so much fun, though. That's
right.
Why you want to root for them, because you want to see that kind of hockey succeed in the playoffs, just so you see more of it.
You see the Golden State Warriors, and we know the NHL is, like every league is, a copycat league, and if the Dallas Stars are able to break through, maybe it does change things, and maybe you don't see so much offense stifled.
You start letting the skill players play again, which, to be fair, we haven't seen a ton of amongst the really successful teams, because the best, most successful teams have systems. And the Stars do, but,
yeah.
I mean, it's a fun system.
Yeah, and the goaltending question mark there as well. Plus, there's, you know, the maybe letdown factor for the St. Louis Blues, who, I mean, I know they wouldn't say it, but it certainly felt like that was their Stanley Cup final in the first round against the Cup champs.
Sure does. I felt like I was watching the Raptors, actually. Like, the Blues and the Raptors were in very similar positions. They had to get over that first round hurdle, especially getting past, like, the Blackhawks, though. That was pretty much like a conference final. That was.
I mean,
it's going to be hard to see better hockey than that this spring. Maybe the Caps and Penguins can deliver on that. But the Blues, Blackhawks game seven was tremendous. And the Blues are a legitimate Stanley Cup contender, especially with Brian Elliott standing on his head, playing really well. Pietrangelo was fantastic in game seven. He's an absolute monster out there. So they have all the pieces that they need. They just, to your point, Ben, they cannot have a letdown the second round. They should handle the Stars. I thought they were going to beat them in five games, even though they lost game one there. And Hitchcock's an awesome coach. Everything's on the table for them. This group has to win. I don't know if it's second round or conference final or bust for them, but...
They got to go.
How far do you think they have to go to consider it a
success? Conference final.
Conference final?
Probably to the Stanley Cup final. But the difference between the Blues and the Raptors, by the way, is that the Blues have Tarasenko, who is, you know, a top 10 player, put the team on your back, get you a goal when you need it. And that's what we were just talking about, the Raptors not having.
When he's playing on the power play and not playing his 30-second shifts, that Ken Hitchcock is not a big fan of, apparently. And that was an interesting...
Ken Hitchcock doesn't like guys like Tarasenko. Did you see Mark Spector's piece? He spoke to Brett Hall.
Yeah, that was a good piece.
Also, breaking in the world of the National Hockey League, the Anaheim Ducks lose Game 7 to the Nashville Predators 2-1. And this was their problem when they had problems early in the season is scoring goals. And Bruce Boudreau, who I thought did a tremendous job adjusting on the fly this season with the Ducks, canned because they couldn't break through against a
typical dumb
Predators
hockey
team.
Move.
Well, yeah, what do we make of it? Because
best power play in the league, best penalty kill in the league, pulled them out of an early season slump that threatened to derail their season, dragged them by the scruff of their neck back into form, and got them into a top seed in the playoffs, then lost a heartbreaking series, and boom, you're gone. Any team that needs a coach, go out and get them right now. Ottawa then, Senators, do it.
Yeah, and then Bob Murray, the Ducks GM, comes out and says yesterday that, you know, like right after firing Bruce Boudreau, essentially, you know, when you fire somebody, you're essentially blaming them for the defeat. Then he has set his guns now on his core players and said he's going to be tougher on them and needs more from them. So I think everything's on the table in Anaheim this offseason. And they're going to make some moves. They're going to move a defenseman. They're probably going to move one of their goaltenders.
It's crazy because they have a good team that could have gone far. Like, you know,
the Western Conference is just a bloodbath.
Yeah, it is a bloodbath. There's eight teams, any of which could go to the Stanley Cup final, really.
The Ducks should have eliminated. They had the Blackhawks last year on the ropes when they were up 3-2, and they let them off the mat, which was, I think, more to do with the firing than what happened this season.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of...
But Boudreau showed this season that he can adjust, too, that he can make adjustments on the fly.
That was
can...
what was so impressive.
Yeah, it was really impressive because they were a cup favorite going into the season, and then they started so horribly.
It looked
like they were out of it, and he grabbed them and stuck them back into the fray, and they did well. Yeah. It's crazy.
Yeah, I'm really surprised they fired him only because they're going to make some personnel moves this offseason. It would have been interesting to see what they do coming back, and Boudreau proved he can adjust on the fly, as mentioned. But also, what this probably comes down to more than anything is it's been widely reported that there's a bit of a rift between Boudreau and Bob Murray, that they don't see eye to eye. So he's almost maybe perhaps looking for a reason to move him out and bring somebody in that's more philosophically and personality-wise aligned with him.
Yeah, it seems like he's a type of guy that has like an expiration date. Bruce Boudreau does. That eventually... You run
with
out
GMs
of
GMs or with
them.
His players?
Well, yeah.
Well, it's funny because
in this case, it might have been the GM.
He couldn't get the Capitals playing good enough defense to go on, and so he got canned there. And now he can't get the Ducks playing good enough offense to go on. So,
well, that was what
there.
Was unbelievable to me. It's this Ducks team was expected to score a ton of goal. Like Getzlaff didn't have like a goal until a couple months into the season. Corey Perry slow start. So he says, okay, that's fine. We're gonna play 2-1 hockey now, and they did. They just kept winning.
And that's the mark of a good coach, right? Finding out what you've got and working with it, right? Yeah. Like, that's what Mike Babcock did with the Leafs this year.
Mm-hmm. It was an impressive season, I thought. I guess Bob Murray didn't think quite as much of him in Anaheim. When we come back, the NFL draft also continuing this weekend. It takes a while. First couple of rounds were real interesting, especially when you look at a guy like Laremy Tunsil, who... tumbled down the first round. We'll talk about what exactly happened with him and why athletes should probably never end up on Twitter or any type of social media.
Or wear masks.
That's coming up next. It's Sportsnet Magazine Live. I'm Ben Annis alongside Mike Cormack and Jordan Heath Rawlings. It's the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Ryan Dixon and Rory Boylan host Tape to Tape, a hard-charging, wise-cracking hockey podcast that goes deep on pucks.
Canada's NHL teams were anything but the Magnificent Seven this season, but misery is about to give way to hope. The annual draft lottery will be held tonight to mark an occasion when every Canadian team has a mathematical shot at the first overall pick. Tape to Tape will be doing a special live podcast beginning at 10 Eastern, 8 Mountain, on the Sportsnet Radio Network, breaking down every bounce of the lottery balls. Tune in to hear us figure out the best options for each Canadian club based on where they land on the draft board. We'll also drill down on the top young prospects available and discuss whether anybody can supplant Arizona boy Austin Matthews as the top pick. Developing prospects may require patience, but you won't have to wait long to hear our forecast for them. Tune in to Tape to Tape tonight for a sneak peek at the path your team should take.
Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Trying to catch the beat. Trying to catch the beat.
With the 13th pick in the 2016 NFL Draft, the Miami Dolphins select Laremy Tunsil, tackle, Ole Miss.
Man, like I said, I'm going to show everybody what type of person I am, man. I'm a great person, despite all the mistakes, man. Like I said, somebody hacked my account. Things happen for a reason. I'm glad to be here, man.
And if you're losing your hide and smoke again. Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network, Ben Annis, Jordan Heath Rawlings, Mike Cormack. So Laremy Tunsil is expected to go top 10, maybe 6. In fact, there is a report now that the Ravens would have taken him at 6 in the NFL draft. He drops to 13, which apparently is a... He lost about $7 million. And the reason for the drop in draft stock is because, like, right as the draft was starting, I guess, or it was like right before it, like, yeah, there was a video posted to his Twitter account of Laremy Tunsil doing a bong rip while wearing a gas mask.
Which shows commitment, which draft scouts usually like. He's committing to the gas mask.
Okay, that was entertaining in its own right, but the agent's comment afterwards was hilarious. Oh, that was not real?
No, that was later proven to be something that you may know. The one where
hilarious.
He was standing up for online freedom of expression or
yes.
whatever. Yeah, no, somebody was playing around with that. But,
well, good on them, because I enjoyed that tremendously, and that he was looking out for the well-being of the people around him by wearing the gas mask.
Just making sure that nobody else got a contact high.
Yeah, that was entertaining. But either way, he ends up as a Miami Dolphin. Now, there's two aspects of this conversation to me. One is what we're talking about here when we're talking about marijuana in the culture. When two states in the United States of America, it is legal.
Just not for football players.
To purchase and consume. Yeah, it is still an illegal substance. And certainly we've seen cases in the last couple of years where guys have suffered serious consequences because they tested positive for marijuana. He also admitted to taking some money to help his mother pay her rent.
Yeah. Again, I mean, funny thing is, it's like marijuana. It's another one of those things that lots of NCAA players do that doesn't get talked about until somebody gets caught.
Well, and do people, okay, who cares about this? Now, I don't mean to say like, oh, who cares, like flipping about it. I mean, like, who are the people that actually care?
Outraged?
Yeah, who are the people that are outraged? Is it fans? Is it the teams? Or is it a worry that there will be outrage?
I don't think it's fans or teams who are necessarily outraged. I think the fall in the draft has to do with the NFL being a conservative culture that worries about what else is out there when you see something like that, right? And the first thing that comes to any NFL GM's mind, and as much as I think it's dumb, I can't really blame them for it, because as soon as you see that, you start thinking about Josh Gordon. And Josh Gordon could be one of the best wide receivers in the NFL, but he's been on the field once in the last 2 years. You know, you can't rely on him. You can't count him. If you're spending that kind of draft capital, you know, we were talking about the third pick or the sixth pick or something. You can't spend that pick if you are really worried that it's not going to pan out and you'll get nothing for your investment. On the other hand, if you knew going into this that you were going to get a top five talent in the NFL draft at number 13, and the worst thing that would ever come out about him was that he smoked some weed and got his coach to pay for his mom's electric bill, I think if you knew that was the worst thing, you would take it in a heartbeat. The problem is you don't know what else is out there.
It worked out okay when the Minnesota Vikings did something similar with Randy Moss back in 1998.
Yeah.
Randy Moss was, what, a top five projected pick?
Yeah.
And he didn't show up for the combine. Went down to 21st overall to Minnesota, had a huge chip on his shoulder, told everybody they were going to regret passing him over, and they sure did. And he had some similar questions about his makeup and his decision-making, and there were questions of him not wanting to be at the combine because he didn't want to do the drug test.
Yeah.
So some guys are weird dudes and do silly things. These are young guys, too. And then they hit the pros, and, you know, the light switch goes off, and they clean up, and they perform. So
or
it's just,
at
it's
the
just
least
a matter
they
of,
smoke in the offseason.
It's just a matter of how much of a gamble, to Jordan's point, are they willing to take at their draft position. And if it's a really high pick, like, you're probably, your willingness to roll the dice is a lot less than it would be if you're picking 21st or 13th.
Yeah, well, it's fantastic because the Dolphins have, like, Mike Pouncey on the offensive line to really help Laremy Tunsil keep his head on straight and stay out of off-field trouble. So it's going to pan out perfectly for them. But in all seriousness, though, just because this is an unprecedented situation in terms of the draft. This is happening live, and we were watching him tumble down the board as Twitter was reacting. Like, it was a real-time draft emergency. And a lot of people will instantly react to that, and I've seen some of it out there, by saying that these guys should just stay off Twitter. You know, they should just get it in their heads. They should be off Twitter. They should be off Instagram. You know, and the reality is that that's a crazy overreaction because, first of all, somebody's always going to have a camera. You can't keep everybody around you off of social media. That's not how the world works anymore. That's 50-year-old coaches who don't understand this stuff talking to 20-year-olds.
Well, the better advice is stay off the Bond mask. That's like the better advice.
Well, even if Tunsil didn't have a Twitter account, somebody else could have leaked it to some other Twitter account or some other method could have been used to end up with us seeing that video. It is interesting that teams are making decisions in real time as we're reacting to it. Like, do you think the Baltimore Ravens would have liked a little more time to understand exactly what was happening?
They basically told Adam Schefter that, right? Like, if the video wasn't there, we would have taken him at six. But what do you? It's hard to blame them in that moment. Like I said, for being conservative, because you don't get a second shot at the number six pick, right? And if you blow it, you blow it.
And then think about how foolish you would look if an hour after taking him, another video pops up.
Yeah.
And then another one. Like, you don't know what the end is.
But this is not like they didn't just meet Laremy Tunsil, right? We know how embarrassing and how stupid some of these questions are that are asked of these draft-eligible players.
He'd said in that process that he'd made mistakes. And I think everybody knew, you know, no team actually had seen videos, but every team knew that there were some off-field questions. And he'd addressed his own character concerns, saying, I'm not that kind of person that you hear about me, but I have made mistakes. Like, that wasn't the first time he said that after the draft. This was the first time he said it after we'd all seen him in a gas mask.
And again, we're talking about mistakes, I think, in quotation marks here.
Yeah, he didn't accidentally put on the gas mask.
All right. And your definition of mistake might be different than his.
I mean, if you're not a professional football player, you know, there are lots of places where that is just a normal Saturday night. Minus the gas mask.
I would argue that if you are a professional football player, maybe you need it even more. But I digress.
A lot of guys have argued that. In fact, Nate Jackson, in his book, Slow Getting Up, former Broncos tight end, talked about how many guys use marijuana, you know, recreationally just to dull the pain for the first part of the week after games. And they try not to get caught, but it helps you sleep when your whole body is aching.
Right. And it's legal in a couple of states and probably more by the time
next season
rolls
along. And
it's
hard to see how it's performance enhancing.
Not in that sport.
No. Seems unlikely. Maybe an eating competition, but not the NFL. All right, before we sign off here, let's continue our talk about the NFL draft. Outside of that, the actual nuts and bolts of the thing, a couple of quarterbacks go 1-2 in Jared Goff and Carson Wentz, and you knew as soon as the Rams and Eagles traded into those top two picks that they were going to – it was just what was the order of those two. We knew those two guys were going 1-2. There was not – the hype surrounding those quarterbacks that there has been in years past. But I guess when you're talking about those two franchises, they evaluated those guys as quarterbacks that can step in and do the job right away, Jordan?
Well, certainly the Rams did with Goff. I think Wentz, Philly has said that they wanted, I mean, before Sam Bradford was talking about a trade, they'd wanted to keep Sam Bradford so they wouldn't have to throw Carson Wentz right into the fire. But the thing about quarterbacks at the top of the NFL draft now is, if you're a team that doesn't have a franchise quarterback that has the Sam Bradfords and the Case Keenums and Nick Foles of the world, you just have to do it. There's no way you can't, because if you don't have that guy, you are just playing from behind in every game that you're in. So there's two guys like that at the top of the draft that are identified as potential franchise quarterbacks, and you have the capital to trade up and get them, and the rest of your team is sort of in a position where they're good enough, if not perfect, and what you're missing is that. You have to do it, and you might miss on them, and they might not be the franchise quarterbacks you're hoping for, but if you don't have one, you're losing anyway. So you can't blame, even if you don't particularly like Goff and Wentz, you can't blame them for making the picks, because that's the league they're playing in.
Yeah, and who knows, one of those guys, it would be rare, I think, if both of them were franchise-altering type players, but certainly it's not out of the realm of possibility that one of them is, and certainly Jared Goff staying in California, the Cal kid playing for the newly formed Los Angeles Rams, will be interesting to watch. And of course, we didn't have time to mention it, but Ezekiel Elliott going 4, which is interesting in its own right, partly because he's a running back, partly because
he
showed his midriff.
Great, yeah, classic
on the red carpet.
Horrible pick, because you never take a running back in the top 10. It's just, it's not worth it. In the same way that you have to take a quarterback in the top 2 if it's there, even if the running back has the skill, you probably shouldn't be taking him in the top 10. The value is just not there, unless you're really just a fan of that suit he was wearing. And I can see you being swayed by
that
bold fashion choice. You're like, we got to get this guy. He has confidence.
And it's too bad people can't see it at home, but Jordan is wearing the same shirt right now.
And,
yeah,
and
well,
it's been
I just
very distracting.
I just rolled it up.
His abs need some work, though. His abs need some work.
Yeah, you know, not what? Exactly ripped.
I'm
like
still
Ezekiel
top 4.
That'll do it. This has been Sportsnet Magazine Live for Mike Cormack, Jordan Heath Rawlings. I'm Ben Annis. This is the Sportsnet Radio Network.